they had a real need for a Latin teacher at the high school. It's only a mile away from me. I could have walked there.
Right.
And they begged me to do this. So I did it, and I go.
And this was people in your community wanted you to do this.
Yeah, the neighbors across the street, people with kids in the school are worried about this, and they asked me to do this, and so I interviewed and took the job, knowing as a libertarian that I'm getting back into something that I hated as a kid, that I have issues with, in the form of motivation, and is it really kidnapping to force kids in there?
Right, right.
And I know this, and I'm thinking, I can't possibly make this worse.
So that's your motivational speech to yourself.
That was it.
Well, if you strike a thorn or rose, keep going.
We're back, everybody.
If it hails or if it snows, keep going.
It actually rains
a lot in June.
Sitting
wide when the fish ain't on your line.
You can buy fish at any supermarket.
Keep trying and keep going. When the weather kills your crop.
Props? How about the cops in Ohio? They're everywhere.
Reach the top, just keep it going.
It's more about the journey.
Every time, hey, getting broke ain't any crime.
Yeah, set aside enough money for your bills, though.
And keep it going.
Tall boy.
Keep it going.
Keep it going.
Keep it going.
Keep it going.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. I am back home in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the studio of Champ Yins. It is Wednesday, June 26th, and I'm really looking forward to releasing to you over the next few weeks all of the content that I created with some fantastic collaborators at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest at the beautiful Circle Pines Campground in Delton, Michigan. So happy that I was able to go back for a second year, make some new friends, reconnect with people I met at the fest the first year I attended in 2018, and I'm already looking forward to my third fest next year. I want to say a special thanks to Joe Motard, the organizer, who helped me feel very welcome, very comfortable, very appreciated. I look forward to this event for months, and my experience there did not disappoint at all. The first show from the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest is already out. It is season 2, episode 11 of The Discomfort Zone. It's called Cat Castle. Andrew and I welcomed a School Sucks listener and parent named Gretchen. It was actually an extension of a conversation that began when Gretchen asked me a question. Right before this, I did a School Sucks live and interactive episode where I took audience questions and we generated a lot of very varied discussion. It was a lot of fun. But because Gretchen's question, it was about sending a child to public school, has the potential for many discomforts, we moved the operation over to a picnic table outside of my space cabin. I had the most exquisite cabin. The entire front of the cabin has a space scene painted on it with stars and planets, and there's even a little Martian waving at you. Pictures will be available of this special cabin that was reserved for me. And thank you to, again, two of the organizers, Joe and Miriam, for making sure I didn't have to sleep in a non-space cabin. But I put that episode of The Discomfort Zone out already. It's one of my favorite Discomfort Zone discussions. You can get it by supporting the show either at schoolsucksproject.com/AV or at patreon.com/schoolsucks. Or you know what? Even at subscribestar.com/schoolsucksproject. And all of those options are linked in the show notes. But that was just a preview, just setting the tone of a lot of really interesting and satisfying discussions I had while I was at the fest, and I look forward to bringing them to you over the next few weeks. Today, we start with Larry Ludlow, and you'll hear me say this in the show, but Larry's a guy I've run into in Detroit, in New Hampshire, at this Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, which is more up north in Michigan. We've always had very fast-paced, multi-topic, fascinating conversations, and so I was happy to finally get him on the show. He was giving a presentation at the event called What a Voluntarist Teacher Should Do in Public School. I said, great, this is our chance to have one of these conversations on the show. And it was like a perfect capture of what our other conversations that I enjoyed so much were actually like. So there's a lot about Larry, his background, what he's reporting on in his speech explained in the show. So I won't say any more about it here. I did decide to call Larry a libertarian teacher in the title. Of course, now you can't tell this in titles because all the words are capitalized. We're talking like small L philosophical libertarian. The word doesn't have a lot of precision, obviously. If, you know, you could call me a libertarian, but you could also call Nicholas Sarwark a libertarian. And the only thing that really connects us is that, you know, I'd like to egg his house or maybe TP his bushes. You know, I mean, now, of course, I wouldn't. I'm a real libertarian, so I wouldn't do these things. But I think about doing it and I smile. I don't know. So I just thought it was a more accessible word for a wider audience. Larry used the word voluntarist, which is a bit of a more obscure term, but also I think a better description for both Larry and myself. And he does a couple of times in the conversation refer to himself as a libertarian. So that's the rationale behind the title. But everything else will be nicely unveiled as we proceed here. So let's get right to it. Much more content coming from the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support of this show. Makes the seizing of opportunities like this possible for me. And I look forward to doing more things. Like every time I do something like this, I feel energized afterwards. And I want to find more events to attend in the coming year. So I can do more of these face-to-face interviews. It's such a different experience. Like, obviously, you know, you can be on Skype or Zoom or whatever and have great connections and great conversations with people. But just sitting at a picnic table with somebody in the woods on a sunny day or sunny evening, it's really a beautiful experience. And I'm grateful that I had it. And I'm thankful to all the people who participated in my awesome experience there. Also, remember, the first School Sucks University Virtual Summit is approaching. If you want more information, if you want to stay in the loop with dates, developments, details on what you are going to get out of this first summit, please go to sspuniversity.com. Just spell it university, though, like for your convenience. sspuniversity.com. I look forward to your participation. All right, here's my conversation with Larry Ludlow. Thanks for listening and take care.
Larry Ludlow, welcome to School Sucks.
Hey, good to talk to you.
It's nice to finally have you on the show. You know what? We're about to have our 10th anniversary of doing this podcast. I started in 2009 and actually spun it off, so to speak, from another podcast that I did with our mutual friend, Wes Bertrand.
Yeah, he turned me on to the whole unschooling thing, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have run into each other here, Detroit, New Hampshire at one point.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've definitely had a few conversations that were always short, always fast-paced, and they seemed like they covered a lot of topics very quickly. And I was excited to see this year at the fest, you were giving a talk called What a Voluntarist Teacher Should Do in Public School.
I think it's something like that. I might have put a funny spin on it for the Facebook page. I think it was maybe what happens when a voluntarist teacher goes into a public school. I mean, I had other titles like Worse Than Ever, Government Schools After 35 Years.
But that was what I wrote. I wrote, after listening to your talk, I wrote the decline of school over 35 years, right? Yeah. Or over my lifetime, basically. Yeah. And you have not been a teacher most of your career.
Correct.
You flirted with the idea back, actually, when I was in first grade.
Oh, that's funny.
You went into the schools as you were trained, and you tried it out for a couple of years, and then you went in a completely different direction. And now that you're retired, you returned. So I want to talk about the changes that you saw. I don't want to call it a decline, because I didn't feel like when I walked in there in 1983, I wasn't like, this place is fantastic. Yeah. I hope they can maintain this. But yeah, I think decline is a fair word in the quality over that period of time for a number of reasons. But first, because this is the first time you've been on the show, just tell my audience a little bit about your background and what you did with most of your career between that time.
Let's see. When I attended university in Detroit and then graduate school in Toronto, I was an academic. I trained in medieval history and in medieval studies, which is an interdisciplinary program, you know, where you study the civilization and, I mean, everything from the science and technology to the literature, the liturgy, the canon law. You'd learn about the music. You'd even do the architecture and art, the philosophy, theology, and whatever specialty discipline you had. It was a pretty advanced program, and you learned to read and not really speak, but you learned to read Latin.
Hmm.
And And so I was going to be a professor, but I really didn't click with my grad school professors. So I might have been immature at the time myself, not being able to deal with that kind of a, you know, conflict, I guess you could say.
Sure, yeah.
And so I dropped that. And then I came back to Detroit, and I thought, you know, I might enjoy teaching for a couple of years. So I got a certificate and taught in the early 1980s for a couple of years. And then I left that. The Detroit schools were very violent at the time, and it was only a matter of time before you had a serious injury.
Yeah, you said there were 300 plus assaults.
It was either somewhere between 250 or 350 assaulted teachers, I think I was told that year by somebody who worked in the administration. I think there were 17 or 20 shootings that year. There was one at a high school I was at. I was teaching French, and there was a shooting in one of the other wings of the building, and you'd find out about it like 4 hours later. It was pretty violent.
So you didn't stick around?
No, I didn't. So I left that, and I became a writer in a construction industry. And first I was doing more technical stuff, but then I moved more and more into marketing and proposals, and I moved to New York. I used to work for a big construction manager there, and then I worked for a business consulting firm, and it was a great job. It was like Ragnar Danisgold in Atlas Shrugged. We moved companies, lock, stock, and barrel from high-cost cities to low-cost cities.
Oh, wow.
And it was the coolest job ever. We had to go into meetings with our clients with sunglasses because they knew we would empty that skyscraper very soon. And they were afraid of us, and it was a badass job and fun. And then I became a freelance writer for about 20 years, writing for new high-tech technologies to launch companies at incubator ad agencies, and for international relocation. In other words, cycling employees around the world. I had a specialty in that because I was working as a consultant in a consulting firm in New York that did that, and I kept at that. And I did pharmaceutical advertising too. And so that's how I kept myself going until I went back into, got hired as a permanent employee for about 5 years and moved to Chicago after San Diego. And then I'm kind of semi-retired for the last couple of years. And so that's how that happened.
So many intellectual pursuits along the way for you as well, because you talk about this background and wanting to go into the academy. But you also said in your speech that when you first entered the public schools in the early to mid-80s, you weren't a libertarian. You didn't have this philosophy. So how did that encounter work for you?
Yeah, if you're raised in most of these public schools, you're going to be some kind of a liberal progressive for most people, unless you have some strong tradition otherwise in your family, which I didn't. And I first encountered ideas contrary to that and about liberty when I was already out of graduate school, and I already had a teaching certificate because I didn't go to education college. I just took an extra certificate to teach kids. But I think it was 1983, I read, the gateway drug back then was Ayn Rand, and I think it was, I read Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, and she hated libertarians, and I had to look that up as we all do. It's like that Jerome Tuccelli book, it usually begins with Ayn Rand, because back then that was the gateway, and then you find out about anarchism and market anarchism, and of course, if you kind of want to make sense of the world, as many libertarians do, you kind of end up that way, yeah.
So how did you, maybe discovering this and feeling somewhat isolated, how did you start making connections with people in this world?
At that time, it was very difficult.
Yeah.
Everything was by mail.
Right.
People contacted me because I started writing letters to the editor and the papers. We did crazy stuff like that back then. And I probably over my lifetime have written maybe 100 letters to the editor under my name or other people's name, at least. I mean, when I was in San Diego, we were active, and people would give me permission to write letters to the editor, and I would sometimes compete with myself, and I would take every letter to the editor in a newspaper would be mine under other people's names.
Right.
They'd be even arguing with each other to one-up the libertarian message, and we had a lot of fun with that, and I've written a lot of essays, but mostly on like anarcho inventions that have to do with the Middle Ages or just other things like that.
Right. So you connected with people here, you connected with people in San Diego, New Hampshire, because you've been all around and parts of these various communities, right? Now in
the old days, you got in touch with each other by calling each other on the phone and by mail. And now the internet makes it so much easier. And it makes it easier to learn about libertarian ideas and in the right order, you know, in an order that makes sense. Like back in the early 80s, you'd find one book out and you'd be reading something that was kind of advanced first, and then you'd read something really mild and kind of milk toasty after, and you're trying to put together because there was nobody else telling you how to learn. I mean, there was no, now it's great. You can learn about everything with great podcasts with lots of different experts, and they all kind of give you a, sometimes they'll give you a reading list of good introductory stuff. There was none of that back then.
Well, so you start with this academic background. You get into this philosophy the hard way, you know, at a time where it's very difficult. Yeah. Over the last 10 years, you know, we've made lots of great connections, both of us, all over the country. And this is a running start for an interesting turn that you make at the beginning of this school year. Semi-retired, you decide that you're going to go back into the schools and teach again. So I know you talked about it in your speech, but for my audience, I'd like you to just talk about what was behind that decision.
Yeah, sure. In middle of 2017, I used to work for Marsh McLennan Companies. I used to work for Mercer in their International City Ratings group. And it was the managing editor for a group of products that tell people that are going to get transferred to a city what it's like to live in that city and how much more you want to pay them if it's like going from, say, Chicago to Mogadishu.
Right, right.
what you got to pay them 40% premium maybe just to tempt them to take the job. So I was laid off because we moved everything to Poland, and I trained all of my replacements, and they were really nice about the layoffs. And I still wanted to keep busy. So I was a member of an economics group here in Detroit where a professor is an Austrian economist, and he teaches at University of Detroit, and he's taught at Walsh College, Harry Verizer, and he's also a devout Catholic, and we always are talking about what's going on at the Catholic schools, and they needed Latin teachers at some of them, but they were too far away in the suburbs, and I'm thinking, it's not worth it. But they said, Larry, you ought to reconsider doing it. And I said, well, I have my certificate's not even valid anymore. So I started thinking about it, and I did love teaching kids.
Yeah.
It's nothing more rewarding than when you get young people to understand something that they didn't understand before that they want to understand. And it's just wonderful.
I hate to say this as a voluntarist and a big supporter of unschooling too, but there's almost like this extra satisfaction. I hate to say this when it starts out against their will. You know, like when you can win somebody over, when they're like, the hell with you, you're just another one of these. They've got you stereotyped based on so many of the experiences they had before. And, you know, I always wanted to be cool teacher. I would lock the textbooks away in the closet on the first day of school. It's like a ceremony. And that, especially working in these really challenging environments that you found yourself in a couple of times, even though the second one, I think, was much more pacified than the first. Sure, there is an extra kind of victory in that.
Yeah, it's really funny because the unschooling regimen and things like Alfie, what's his name?
Alfie Cohen,
yeah, he talks about intrinsic motivations and stuff. And there's a great deal of truth in that. But it's always like life is always a little more complex than that because, I mean, let's face it, we are creatures who, because we live in a physical environment, we have to convert matter and energy from one form to another to live. Mm. And it doesn't come automatically. We actually have to suffer a little to do it. In other words, life, you can't blame gravity because it makes you hurt when you fall. And it's just the way life is. There really is some effort, and guys like Jordan Peterson would call it sacrifice, have to be made. And so I love the idea of unschooling so that kids can go after stuff they're motivated about. But there is an element of life that means sometimes you actually have to learn at something you have to struggle with and don't want to know. And
resistance has to be encountered at some point. Sure.
And it's a tough line to draw. And you can get teachers that don't acknowledge that in their kids. And this is a problem because the kids need to know that it's okay and understandable that you're not motivated to learn something like in my classes. So, you know, I'm living in Grosse Pointe and I'm semi-retired. They had a real need for a Latin teacher at the Grosse Pointe South High School. It's only a mile away from me. I could have walked there.
Right.
And they begged me to do this. So I did it. And I go.
And this was people in your community wanted you to do this.
Yeah. The neighbors across the street, people with kids in the school are worried about this. And they asked me to do this. And so I interviewed and took the job, knowing as a libertarian that I'm getting back into something that I hated as a kid, that I have issues with, you know, in the form of motivation. And is it really kidnapping to force kids in there?
Right, right.
And I know this, and I'm thinking, I can't possibly make this worse.
So that's your motivational speech to yourself.
That was it. I mean, I couldn't make it worse. And so, I would tell the kids when I'd get in there, I'd say, look, I know a lot of you are forced to be in here against your will. And I even did this when I was a liberal teacher because I didn't want to snow job the kids. And so there was a spark of it. But I would tell them, look, you're forced to be here. We can't do anything about that. And I'm not going to tell you that I'm the best Latin teacher or that you're going to get the world's wonderful unlocking before your eyes as a result of this. If you want to go to sleep, fine. But there, I have to mark you accordingly. You might want to listen because there are worse people than me to do this job. And so I wouldn't snow them. And so I would tell them this, and I would even empathize with their failure. I would say, look, you don't want to be here. Some of you aren't geared to learning languages, or not now, because I wasn't as a kid. I learned it at university and when I wanted to. And I'd say, if you're failing at this, this doesn't mean you're a failure. It just means they're making you come to a class you don't want to, and I have to follow the law and do this. And I'm open about the restrictions I'm under. And I think they kind of like this honesty that, you know, yeah, you're going to do this. I'm going to have to do this. I don't think it's right, but that's where we are. And they can take it or reject it.
How old were they?
These were high school kids this time. They were probably 9th, 10th, and 11th graders. And they had to take 2 years of a language. I'd even go over failures in my life just to show them that it doesn't, just because you fail doesn't mean you've done something wrong. And I would even tell them, you have to fail dozens of times to learn stuff.
Okay, I mean, here's an interesting question. So I used to be an SAT tutor, right? Mm-hmm. This is back to what we were talking about on the issue of motivation.
Yeah.
So I would be working with AP level kids, schools outside the greater Boston area. So lots of money. Needham, Massachusetts was like the hub that I operated in. So super competitive. Everybody lives next door to the Joneses. That kind of everybody has to get into Ivy League schools. Later, I went on to run an exclusively SAT tutoring and college consulting business in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So similar situation, lots of money to devote to these kinds of extracurricular educational enhancements, as parents saw it anyway, and as parents were willing to pay a lot of money for. I was always surprised by the lack of vocabulary knowledge that even these very smart, very, for lack of a better word, privileged kids had. Most had not taken Latin. Most didn't understand that about 3/4 of the English language had been derived from Latin. And, you know, I'd ask them questions like, well, how did you get vocabulary in school? Like when you get, you know, vocabulary quizzes, what is the assembly of the word list? Like what's the assembly based on? And they would say, I don't know, nothing. The words didn't seem to have any relation to each other at all. So, you know, I would say you can unlock an understanding of thousands of English words by knowing 100 Latin roots, right? And then you can actually figure out, like, I don't expect any of you to know what intransigent means, but clues are there to figure out this way. If I said it's like the affect of a person, or you know, I can show you how to break that word down and understand what the word means. And you know, I felt like a lot of stuff in math too. It was like I was revealing magic spells.
Yeah.
You know, kids had never been given any understanding of how anything worked or why. Yeah. And you know, to that, I'm wondering why, contrasted to my experience where most of these kids had no foundation and understanding of the language, you're encountering 9th, 10th, 11th graders who are taking Latin. Is it just part of a college requirement? I would think that generally, I hope I'm wrong, but their investment would be pretty low in wanting to learn a dead language.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I would even ask the kids this. There were a few kids who would come up to me and say, I really want to learn this. I mean, I wanted to learn it because I was a medievalist and I had to learn it. And I always was fascinated by those Carolingian minuscule letters, you know, from that, you know, were invented during Charlemagne's time by Alcuin and his bunch. But these kids had very poor language skills in general, I thought. They didn't know. I mean, and I did too when I was their age. I wasn't motivated to diagram sentences. I never learned it. I taught myself that before I went to college, because I didn't go to college for a couple of years. I taught myself when I was ready. And this is, again, back to that you have a motive. And boys, I think, have this exhibit this more strongly. They won't learn something unless they have a reason.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. So I would always tell the kids, I'd say, look, you may not want this now, and that's okay. If you fail this class, you can just remember these parts, and you'll get enough points to pass this class at a low level and not have to retake it, which is a good goal for somebody who's not motivated. You won't be punished anymore, you know,
right,
if you go this minimal route, which I think is an honest way to deal with it, because they can get through the course, not fail, and not have to retake it. And it lets the kids who really want to excel show, you know, that they're into it. And there were a number of kids who are great, but their English and language skills were bad. They'd never been prepped about even thinking about words. They'd never heard anyone talk about etymology, like what these words came from and what the cognates are in English. And I spent a lot of time, because it's a mnemonic device, it helps them remember. If they can think of English words that come from it, they can, if I have to give them a test, you know, they'll kind of,
yeah,
kind of a thing. But yeah, it's tough to motivate them that. So I was just honest with them. I'd say, yeah, you're being forced to take this. I'm going to make it possible for people who are uninterested to pass through it without feeling shamed. Mm-hmm. And I went through several of my life failures, just even personal things. I'd say, this was devastating. Boom. I even talked about my divorce and went through stuff and just how horrible it was. And I say, so, but you can live through this. And this is a nothing compared to a real failure, because this is your... this is normal failure, because you're not interested in it.
Right,
so
yeah.
I wanted them not to feel that I thought less of them for this, because that's a real barrier if kids feel failure. And you know how sensitive they are as teenagers. They're figuring out who they are, and they're getting rejected on dates or afraid to make a date. And then they have a teacher who's just grinding them into the floor. They don't want this, you know?
And there's a lot of parental pressure, too. There's that reinforcement. And in the school, you know, I started hearing years ago about schools were saying that your graduation year, or you are class of, like I was class of 95, for example. But if there was and there was lots of pressure to go to college then, you know, but now they're saying, okay, instead of class of 95, you're class of 99, because that's when you'll graduate from college. And if you fall short of that, you're basically a dropout. Yes. You're basically a failure. So the pressure to go to college and, you know, the financial, the perverse incentives that are provided, there's that. But parents buy into that very well. Parents outsource a lot of thinking and a lot of responsibility to society, obviously, as far as the value that society attaches to college. But everybody from the guidance counselors to the teachers to the principals, they're reinforcing that idea as well. So you said in your talk that parents really weren't even advocating for their kids on a motivation level either. They're saying, hey, we have this checklist of things we need to do for the application. This needs to be an A. So, like, how do
they
we make that?
They wanted a result. Yeah. They wanted a result that would give them other results that they wanted. And they really didn't care if it had any relationship to reality at all. They were literally that goal-oriented and short-circuited in their thinking. And in Austrian economics, I'd even think of it, they were perfect examples of high time preference behavior.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
wanted it now, and they didn't care if it was based on reality. And the parents were every bit as childish and short-sighted as their kids. And the idea of integrity does not exist, because these parents were probably about your age. They were young enough to be my children. And I can see that the level of connection between reality, integrity, and result has already had one level of disconnect. And the kids would just say flat out, we need A's so that we can go to the next step. And that's what it was all about. There were teachers who would give them scores that they needed.
So you talked about one of the parents complaining and trying to bargain with you because in a Latin 2 class, her son had performed better in the Latin 1 class. Right. And I think maybe there's that attitude like this is Latin. It's not practical. So it should just be like a gimme. Yep. Right. It should be easy.
That's exactly what they were looking for. They were dumping kids who had flunked other languages like Spanish and French into my classes. And Latin is highly inflected, more so even than Spanish and French. And you really can learn to think very clearly by studying Spanish or Latin grammar because you're understanding the relationship of words much more closely than when you automatically learn any language. And this parent, her son had taken Latin 1 and apparently had done relatively well. I never looked at his score, but the Latin 1 that he had had, I knew how far they went. It's just introducing you to the idea of words that change ending depending on their function in the sentence or verbs that change their ending depending upon their function in the sentence. And in Latin, you know, you've got basically six ways a noun can be used. And then in the plural form, there's another six. So you've got 12 endings on any one word potentially.
Yeah.
And the verbs, again, however many endings you have for the three persons in plural and singular. So there's six for each one. And that's only for each tense. And there's like past, far in the past, perfect. Then there's past. And then there's imperfect. There's present, future perfect. Then you have subjunctive moods, indicative moods. You have vocative. I mean, and you have imperative mood. So you've got all these structures. They've never heard any of this stuff. And the endings have to change. And so the kids take in Latin 1 where they just talked about one kind of noun and six endings. And he'd mastered a little bit of that, but the second year really piles on. Once you've got the concept, then they want you to replicate it in all kinds of different forms. So it's about four or five times harder.
Yeah.
And the parent was very goal-oriented. They just wanted the score. They didn't care how it got there. And you can't really argue with that because they have been trained to think that their kid needs to go to college. And we all know it's a financial disaster now because the college prices have been inflated because the government throws money at it, which raises it higher. And these kids don't understand the idea of sacrifice. And it's to do something well. And it's hard to do that because it's true. There is a cusp, kind of a knife edge between what's intrinsically motivated and when are you just being forced to go through the motions you don't want to go through.
Right.
But as we were saying earlier, life does require certain sacrifices, but sometimes it's so meaningless. And even if they do well, it might be meaningless because it has nothing to do with what they really want.
That's kind of the trick with Latin. I'm wondering if you ever had to endeavor to explain the value of all these finer details of Latin to one of these parents. We're like, hey, let's get on with the getting of the A here. And
yeah, they didn't care. They didn't care. They didn't give a whit.
So you tried. You tried.
Yeah. And I've encountered too, and there is a unflattering word for some of these mothers. I know a number of people in the community, and there is a certain kind of a hovercraft mother or helicopter mom who overprotects their child from the pain of growing. And there are reasons psychologically some mothers do it. Sometimes it's just because they haven't been raised around men and they don't know when children need to be challenged. They don't realize that growth really does come through doing different things. And so they want to protect their children from hurt feelings and feelings of failure, but they don't. Instead, they would have been better off telling their children, you know, if you learn something now, you'll benefit more later, even though it's more painful. And you run into meaningless, you know, make work stuff, which can be called a challenge, but isn't. But so these parents, but they don't realize that they can't protect their kids from these changes. And you can see it at universities now. These kids are needing safe spaces. They're needing trauma rooms because just for encountering an idea they don't like, because they've been protected from any dissonance whatsoever.
Yeah, Lenore Skenazy, who has a blog called Free Range Kids, she's pretty aligned with a lot of the definitely the unschooling movement. She's spoken at Free State events. She called it bubble wrapping. Which is like a, like helicoptering was what I dealt with maybe.
And now it is bubble. It's gone a step further.
It really is. And I think a part of it is, you know, I'd imagine it'd be worse in like economically stressed areas where a lot of people are middle class and a lot of kids are latchkey. You know, I mean, and I even worked with really, really wealthy kids mostly, and both parents still worked. And they were outsourcing a lot of education. Like I said, thought, consideration, engagement was all outsourced to people like me. I would come into a house, be taken to another room with this child and left for 2 hours. And it was a lot of things like as far as like educational enrichment or checking in, like how are you doing? Things that I would think would be the responsibility of a mother and a father were being done by this third party stranger a lot of the times. And in a lot of the cases, I was just a like an enforcement arm of the school, because when I started tutoring, when I left teaching and started tutoring, I was just there like, hey, you're getting a C. That's a problem. Yeah. You're defective.
Well, there's no meaning that the kids derive from that, because what's funny, what you're describing is kind of they've like if a, at the time when a parent would have homeschooled a child, as was often the case for much of our history of being literate, that that parent knows that child intimately, and they can actually make explanations and connections between the different things they learn in the life of that kid. When you totally outsource all of these special sub-disciplines to people, a lot of times it's just a series of interrupted pieces of information that I think it would be hard for any person to integrate into anything meaningful. And even the very idea of meaning is sidelined these days, because children are basically put into a situation where they're told to absorb certain things. They're not taught to ruminate over it and make it mean something to them. And they don't, this is one of the great things about guys like Jordan Peterson. They're returning to the idea that we have to, our life has to be a story about ourselves and has to mean something to you, which gets back to intrinsic motivations and what do you want to be and what do you want to be known for? What do you, and this can change a million times for kids, but when parents are outsourcing all these specialties, I really think they're getting disconnected from their kids.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then the school, because there's a lot of turmoil and there's a lot of potential for failure.
And form filling. It's all checkboxing at schools.
But the other thing is they see the vulnerability or the frustration in their kids. And while they've been pushing all these responsibilities, I mean, I understand why and how it happens. You know, I remember growing up in a one income household, and then things changed and my mom had to go back to work. So I'm sympathetic to these situations. But from my experience working, like being in so many people's houses and seeing so many parents, the school, it was always mothers, never fathers. And I think you said the same
it's
in your speech.
Yeah.
That were intervening. I think they feel, this is what I picked up. I'm not trying to make this a rule for all mothers who do this, but they understand that they've overlooked a lot of nurturing opportunities. And when they see something come up in the school, they say, oh, this is where I will overcompensate.
I can pounce here.
Right. I will
make up for all my guilt feelings of not having been involved in outsourcing my children's upbringing to other people.
Yeah.
And it's always, I think more and more, this is a big mistake, not having a parent know their kid, because a bunch of professionals don't have the time or inclination or expertise to know 150 kids. I'm trying to think, when I had like six classes, I would have had 200 kids a year when I taught back then. Now it was only a couple of classes. But even with a couple of classes, you can't possibly know as much about those kids. You don't have the time. You almost can't know. And they all have stories, too. I mean, some of these kids, their families were broken up. They had a parent who had died the previous year. Each of those kids, if they had been taught by a parent or a trusted family nebula member, you know, somebody within their community that knew them from the womb to the tomb, so to speak, knew the continuity of this kid's life, the experience of learning would have been much more integrated and rewarding, and there'd be more meaning in it for the kids, and the kids' trajectory of who they were would be known to someone instead of just running them through a bunch of courses that maybe have no bearing on who they are.
Right? Exactly. So I want to give one more opportunity for us to bond and my audience to bond with you over the problems of school, over why school sucks, and then I'm going to ask you to deliver on the title of your presentation, what you should be doing in the school, right? Talk about how the culture of school has changed from your first encounter as an educator to your return over the last school year. Like, what was alarming to you about political messaging or cultural messaging?
Yeah, I think we've already touched on the declining expectations of schools, and that's borne out in all of these reports on schools and the quality. Another thing I noticed, there is a real political bent to this stuff. When I first was certified to teach, and I think it was 1982, the certificates just had your name, what you're certified to teach, and a signature block.
Yeah.
It was empty. Now it is crammed with text, all of it politically motivated stuff, and it's all about common good ideas and service toward, none of which have to be there. The primary goals about democratic societies, practicing equity and equal access to education. I mean, it's all teachers' union language that self-promotes the structure of this bureaucracy and perpetuates it. These new diversity words appear in there as if you weren't treating kids as individuals before, but it's not enough for them now to treat someone as an individual. The word diversity doesn't mean that to them. It means protecting and privileging certain protected groups and almost denouncing others instead of treating people individually, which is what they are.
What I saw happening too, and it's true in higher education. I actually talked to a professor named Duke Pesta on the show recently, who was kind of fighting the PC war at, he was an English professor in Wisconsin, is that the equality has become such a religion that, you know, I think it used to be like terms like privilege, right? It seems like the left's, I would question its sincerity then, but back at the beginning of like the Great Society programs, it was very much focused on uplift, you know? And I think there's really this mostly subconscious awareness, even at the highest levels of analysis in academia, that programs of uplift failed in many ways to deliver results. But because the religion of equality is still so strong, the question is like, okay, how do we level? How do we level? And now, instead of saying, look, there's people down here and this is unfortunate and let's lift them up. I mean, that's still part of it. But now the new angle is there's people up here and let's bring them down. Let's check our privilege. And this is really has an analog in the schools as well, where lots of teachers who are demanding a lot of students at the high school level, at the college level, are saying, look, we're holding kids back. You know, we're holding kids back in an effort to level this playing
field. You
know,
what you're saying here is, it's interesting. I never thought of this before, but it's almost like what these parents wanted this level of performance to be registered no matter what their kid was doing. And we're also seeing this demand for what's called equity, and that means equality of result. And so in a way, it's almost like, just like the parents want the mark of a achievement without any of the effort, this progressive movement wants this equality regardless of the totally patent difference between every human being in the world. In other words, they all want to pretend that everything is perfect all the time. It's really a perpetuating a story that everyone's the same, that there you can't rank performance. It's a denial of individuality in a way. And it's just bizarre, because if you have this short-sighted goal of having everyone be getting prizes like in Alice in Wonderland, you know, prizes for all. That's another way of saying no one can be better than anyone else. It's just a flip side of it. And like you were saying before, it was leveling. You want to bring people up to a level, and the government money hasn't made a change significant since the Great Society. In fact, it may be made. Well, there's a good bit of evidence that it's made it worse, I should say.
Sure.
And so the point is, people it has to be more of an emergent quality, that spontaneous order where people emerge into what they are and they're good at who they are and they don't all get measured against each other. Because this whole idea of measuring everything is a relatively modern practice. This is something that started with a guy, Auguste Comte, a French guy who started this positivism, and it's affected every discipline. There's legal positivism now, there's scientific positivism, there's ethical positivism. What this says is, if you can't measure it, it doesn't matter, and it's not scientific if you can't measure it.
So but, what's cast away with that?
They're casting away meaning, because measurements are a real abstraction of reality. Like if we are right now, we're outdoors in this area with all this green foliage and so forth. And one way of measuring this would be to say those leaves are on the spectrum of, you know, the red to violet or whatever the spectrum is. We are surrounded by, you know, 0.31 micro units of green. That's one way of describing this for us, but it doesn't tell us anything about the meaning of this for us, that it's a home for a bluebird.
Right.
That leaf is food for a larva.
Yeah.
You see, and this is one of the problems of guys like Steph Molyneux. He's a reductionist, ultimately. It's true that syllogisms are a great, you know, thinking tool, but when you abstract something down to a syllogism, how much of a relationship anymore does it have to the living, breathing world around us? It's narrowed it down to a really small part. And it's correct about that, but it's no longer representing reality. And this is the problem of positivism.
So is that like, just to make sure people understand, including myself, to pin something into a really specific definition,
that
you kind of
measured,
you lose the meaning of
the
larger system that it's a part of.
You're
okay.
Sucking it out of its real context, and you've decided to examine such a tiny part of it that you actually can measure. But what does that really tell you about the whole thing? And there's a great guy here, Bruce Weber, who introduced me to this guy, Korzybski, who says this great phrase, the map is not the territory. In other words, the abstract flat picture on a piece of paper of this geographic area, it's not the same thing as the mountains and valleys and flowing rivers and holes and bogs that you actually touch and feel and smell. What's the relationship of that map of the state of Michigan to the ground that we're looking at now? You can measure the one, but is it really telling the full story? And this is the problem of reductionism. It's a problem of positivism. It's the problem of something called scientism. This is when these so-called scientific people, they're not, they're scientistic, but they're positivists, and they're trying to say the only reality is that which can be measured. And this is not science. This is one facet of a trillion facets about reality. And they're thinking just because they can measure the water pressure in something, that tells you everything. Or I can tell the spectrum of the green on these leaves. That tells me everything. And it's hubris on stilts. And there's that great Michael Polanyi, the Hungarian Nobel Prize winner, was among a group of brilliant Hungarians. He's even basically paraphrased it down to, if you can measure it, and even if you can describe it, it's probably not that important or representative. But if you can't explain it, and if it's too complex to measure or explain, it's probably the only important thing. And that's what they're missing when we measure all these grades. Some of these classical schools, now that they're reviving, they don't have as nearly as much measuring or weekly testing. And it's kind of more organic, and the kids grow into it more. And I think that's kind of more humane. But getting back to this parent thing you mentioned, and this leveling up and leveling down, the idea of leveling is all based on measuring.
Yeah.
And all of these stupid econometric economists, the ones who will say, oh, we can measure a trade deficit with China. Well, we all know as libertarians that it doesn't matter. I'm always running a trade deficit with my Kroger grocery store. They've never bought a damn thing from me. Does
right.
that mean it's bad and it's got to be fixed? It's got to be fixed,
right.
like our so-called trade with China? Of course not. But that kind of lunacy comes out of the logic out of the positivism. Oh, we can measure this economic flow, and that means something. It doesn't. We know that these kind of imbalances, you're buying my service or I'm buying yours, I may never hire you. Does that mean there's something wrong? No. And that's all of these measurements of equality and equity and leveling. All of it's based on, oh, we've measured something, and that's the only thing we're allowed to talk about, and we've got to change society because of this thing we can measure.
And it's very dehumanizing, too. Yeah. And you know, you think about something just in terms of education that is so dynamic and so personal, like and dynamic through a person's life, dynamic through the process of learning one friggin' thing.
Yeah.
You know, how much it can change.
Yeah.
Motivation, interest, all of these different facets, the desire to communicate to other people about new discoveries. And it's taking the humanness out of that entire process, while at the same time, tragically, substituting schooling for education.
Yeah.
People equate, that's one of the things we try to do over and over again. I try to embed it in every episode of the show. And there's over 600, so hopefully this is catching on, that school does not equal education. Because what you're talking about has been going on, really intensifying since the time I was born with the foundation of the Federal Department of Education. But this existed. I mean, this goes all the way back to the progressive era.
Yeah.
You know, removing all of these nuances from actual education for the sake of efficiency in schooling.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you adding that context. I mean, I assume the positivism is like a thoroughly modernist kind
of. It is. And it's taken the meaning out of life because people don't even think about who they are now. They're thinking about, oh, am I equal enough? Am I equal enough? This is crazy talk because as we've already talked about the absurdity of these so-called trade imbalances, but it's everything. If you measure everything, it doesn't mean it's important. And it gets back to that wonderful story about Procrustes. This is the story of the Greek story about the guy who had an inn by the side of the road, and he would have people that would stay at his inn, and if they were too tall and couldn't fit in his bed, to make them equal to that bed, he would lop off their feet.
Right, right.
If they were too short, he would stretch them out.
Right.
And this is what positivism brings. Yeah, he could measure the length of a bed, and damn it, he's going to make everything abide by that measure. And that's how crazy this is.
So final question. Title of the talk, what should a voluntarist teacher do in public school? You've had a year to decide.
You know, what I would say is there's an answer for every person.
Yeah.
And it's different for every person. I mean, I know that I would say a third of the kids are destroyed by public school organized for most of their lives. There might be a time when it would work. Mm-hmm. There's a third of the kids, it doesn't have any impact, and a third of them thrive on it. So I think at different parts of different people's lives, there's a place for homeschooling, for unschooling. Then there might be room when they get how to work in that and not let it ruin them, if done right, to be in a more structured setting. But it has to change with the kid during their life. And you also have to have a relationship with a real person.
Yeah.
And that's missing in these factory monopoly schools. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I think you covered the answer to that question along the way in our talk as well, because you said you acknowledge that this is force, right? You acknowledge that this is involuntary, and that's a very, very important perspective to extend, right? Because I don't know if that even occurred to me going. I hated school.
Yeah.
I wasn't a good student. I didn't think I was smart, and I was just subtly learning that this is what life is. That it's not that there are little pockets of enjoyment.
That school sucks. That's what you were learning.
Yeah, but almost extending it to life sucks.
Yeah.
Because, like, I have no power. I have no control. I'm not good at things.
That's what they learn in schools.
And so you see how kids get addicted from everything to television, to drugs, to video games, is that outside of what is the norm, you can find little pockets of escape and enjoyment instead of having a fulfilling and enjoying life in its whole.
That's a good observation. Yeah.
This has been an awesome conversation, Larry. Thank you so much. It was great to have you on the show.
Great.
And
great
thanks
talk.
For your great talk, too.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it. Good talking to you, Brett.
When it looks like all is up, keep a going.
Oh, yeah.
Drain the sweetness from the cup.
ain't no use to sit and whine. When a fish ain't on your line, bait your hook, keep it dry, to keep going.
Keep a going.
Keep a going.
Now keep a going.
Keep it going.
Keep it going.
Keep it going.
Keep